One painless bite from a tick the size of a poppy seed, and you might find yourself battling a baffling infection. This hour, we'll look at Lyme disease and the complex life cycle of the Lyme-carrying tick. Is Lyme disease on the rise? What can you do to protect yourself and your animals? Plus, do you avoid tall buildings because you have a fear of heights? Coming up, we'll get to the bottom of fear and explore when it goes from being a natural response to being debilitating. And a look at a treatment for arachnophobia that researchers say is quick and lasting. After this.
Got a hankering for a bit more conversation? You didn't like what you heard? You want to hear more of it? Well, you can keep the chat going at Science Friday's Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/scifry. Or you can tweet us all week long at SciFry. That's at SCIFRI.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky, in for Ira Flatow. You've probably already encountered them this year, buried deep in your pet's fur, maybe on your own skin. Yes, ticks. These bloodsuckers are often no bigger than a poppy seed, but they can wreak havoc with your health and your pet's. Infected ticks are the main culprits in the transmission of Lyme disease. It's being blamed for causing a senior banker, J.P. Morgan, to miss a lot of work, leading to a more than $2 billion blunder. Lyme disease can be debilitating. The symptoms can range from fever and fatigue to neurological problems. But there's not agreement about how to diagnose and treat the infection. After all, Lyme disease has been called the great imitator. Its symptoms often mimic those of many other ailments. So how is Lyme disease transmitted? Why is it so tricky to detect and treat? And are we really seeing more of these nasty ticks than ever before? If you have a question about Lyme disease, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet us your questions by writing the at sign, followed by SciFry. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you will find links to our topic. Let me bring in our guests. Dr. William Schaffner is professor and chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine and professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He joins us from Nashville today. Welcome back to Science Friday, doctor.
Good to be with you, John.
Dr. Thomas Mather is a professor of public health entomology and director of the Tick Encounter Resource Center at the University of Rhode Island. People refer to him as the tick guy, and he joins us today on phone from Kingston, Rhode Island. Hi there, Dr. Mather.
Hi, John. Glad to be with you today.
I'll start with you, Dr. Mather. When exactly is one most at risk of contracting Lyme disease?
Well, the season of greatest risk is when the nymphal stage ticks are out. That's the poppy seed size tick that happens to be out right now. So this year, with the warmer winter, I think they came out a few weeks earlier than normal. So we're not quite in the peak of their season yet. It's still a little bit early, but people are finding them right now and through July, usually. Depends on the humidity that we get in the early part of the summer. If it's hospitable to ticks, which means higher humidity, then the ticks will linger on into the summer longer, and if we get drier conditions, they'll die off a little bit sooner, and so people's tick encounter risk will be a little bit less.
What kind of habitat do they like? Is it just woods? Is it fields? Any types of plants more than others?
Yeah, so definitely woods. They're in leaf litter. These poppy seed-sized ticks hide in the leaf litter and then will latch on to small animals that run through the leaf litter, like mice and chipmunks or ground-dwelling birds, or people that are shuffling through the leaf litter along a woodland trail. But they often are around the edges of people's yards and in their shady gardens as well. Places where you see mice and chipmunks running, then those are likely places that these ticks can be as well.
And explain the different types of ticks we're talking about here. Deer ticks, dog ticks, what are the ticks we need to be worried about?
Yeah, so there are about 9 species of human-biting ticks across the United States. And happily for us, only 2 species really are transmitters of Lyme disease spirochetes. Both have fancy scientific names called Ixodes as the genus, and the main culprit is Ixodes scapularis. That's the eastern black-legged tick. Some people refer to it as the deer tick as well. And then there's the western black-legged tick, and people just refer to that as the western black-legged tick for some reason, don't know why. And so we get transmission wherever those ticks occur. The other ticks, like the American dog tick that people are probably a little bit more familiar with, or let's say if you're from the south, the Lone Star tick, yes, they bite, they suck blood. They don't transmit Lyme disease spirochetes, though.
So, Dr. Schaffner, are you at greater risk of getting Lyme disease in certain parts of the country? Are these ticks everywhere now?
Well, the ticks are pretty widespread, and as Dr. Mather said, the different species are in different parts of the country, but Lyme disease is concentrated particularly in the northeastern and north central states, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, where it was first described, Pennsylvania. And then there's a cluster up in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and then another cluster across the country in Northern California and Oregon.
And are these ticks moving around as the weather changes, as maybe the temperatures warm up?
Well, I think they're transmitted usually locally, but if they get on deer, for example, the deer can carry them from one part of the forest or the woods to another.
So how exactly is Lyme disease transmitted to humans? And maybe you can explain this. Dr. Mather, I'll go to you first, and then maybe Dr. Schaffner, you can jump in there.
Well, so people get Lyme disease after they're bitten by a tick. The ticks carry pathogens that they pick up from reservoir hosts. So it's a bit of a complex life cycle in a sense that there are two, I'm going to have to describe two groups of animals involved in this. There's a group of animals that just provides blood for the adult stage deer tick or western black-legged tick. Those are white-tailed deer for the most part. They'll feed on dogs, they'll feed on cats, but the populations are really supported by feeding on deer. But the deer don't infect these ticks. The deer probably infected themselves, but they don't have enough of a dose of the pathogens to infect the ticks. So they provide blood. The blood is used by the adult ticks to reproduce, to lay eggs. They can lay 1,500 or 2,000 eggs each tick. And so then the stage that hatches out of the eggs, though, they're called larvae. And the larvae will feed on a whole variety of animals. And if they happen to feed on another group, mainly rodents, white-footed mice, chipmunks, then they potentially pick up pathogens from them, and then they carry those pathogens into the next stage, which is that middle stage that we refer to as the nymph. It's the poppy seed stage tick. So generally speaking, nymphs that bite through the summer, and then adults that bite in the fall and winter and spring are the stages that are infected. But because the adult ticks are a little bit bigger, they're more readily seen by people mm-hmm. and more frequently removed before the transmission of the pathogens occurs. But the nymphs, being so small, basically sneaky biters, they crawl up to places that most people never look, like around their backsides, and they get bitten, and before you know it, that's how the transmission can occur.
Dr. Schaffner, what else should we know about this? About this cycle that they go through when they start biting you? Do they have to hang on for a certain amount of time before you get infected?
Well, the longer they hang on, the more likely it is that transmission, if that tick happens to be infected, will transmit the organism, the bacteria, to us. And so there's much to be said that if you've been out and about, check yourself when you come back in and have somebody else check the back of your hair and, as Dr. Mather says, your backsides also, because you can't really twist around and see that very well.
If you want to join us, what's that?
Pretty clever. my story is that a few years ago, my wife bought me the biggest mirror the local furniture store had, and with little notes said, "You're on your own, buddy. Good luck."
Well, if you want to join us with some of your tick stories and to ask questions about Lyme disease, 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. Let's go to Dustin, who's in San Antonio. Hi, Dustin.
Hi. My question was, I'm an avid hiker. Most of my hiking has been in the Appalachian Mountains around Virginia, and I've probably been bitten by at least two or three dozen ticks and caught I don't know, maybe 100 or 200 throughout my hiking career. As I understand it, Lyme disease is very difficult to detect, and I don't know of any symptoms I have, but what should someone in my position do? Should I get checked? Is the test even reliable?
So, Dustin, what you ought to do is just be aware of the fact if you develop any skin lesions, because the hallmark of the early stage of Lyme disease is a really quite prominent skin lesion, which is red and spreads in a circular fashion. It just kind of spreads out, and that's called erythema migrans, the migrans because it continues to enlarge. Erythema means that it's red, and that's the hallmark. And if you get that, get some attention quickly. They can diagnose Lyme disease and give you appropriate treatment.
This is the so-called bullseye lesion, but not everyone gets it, right, Dr. Schaffner? I mean, you can have Lyme disease but not get this rash.
That is correct, but the vast majority of people do. Some of the people who think they didn't have the lesion probably had it someplace where it was not readily seen.
Hmm. So does this warm winter mean that we're going to see more cases of Lyme disease this year? We were hearing earlier on about the humidity maybe making ticks a little bit more active. Dr. Schaffner, do you think this warm winter means we're going to see a lot more Lyme this year?
Well, I dare say. Now, down in Tennessee, we have more of the dog tick transmitted Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and we've already had more cases this year than we've had in comparable periods in the past. So we're looking out for all kinds of tick transmitted diseases.
So Rocky Mountain spotted fever, not just Lyme disease, there's a host of these other diseases that ticks can carry. Do we need to worry about all of them?
Sure, there are just more ticks going to be out there because the winter has been mild, just as Dr. Mather said. So there's another disease called ehrlichiosis, and the variety of ticks are going to be out there, I think, in abundance this year.
And Dr. Mather, do you think the same thing?
Well, I think that there are definitely more ticks in more places than ever before, and I'll include all of the different species of ticks in that statement. And that, I think, is something worth exploring a little bit. I have my pet hypotheses about that. But I really am not as sure that the warm winter has much to do about the levels of ticks. I think the timing of them is affected by the warmer winter. But for instance, in the case of deer ticks, the adult stage ticks were active all winter. A lot of times in the northeast and north central states, they are buried in snow, and so they're not really active in the winter. So this year, they were active across the winter season, and I believe that caused them to actually disappear a little bit sooner than they normally do because they had used up all of their energy reserves.
Well, when we come back from this break, we'll talk a little bit more about diagnosing Lyme disease and why that's so difficult.
Ira here, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do, our radio show, podcast, Facebook, Twitter, and more, if you appreciate that and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to contribute whatever you can by pressing on the donate button on your smartphone or iPad app or going to our website at sciencefriday.com and making a tax-deductible donation. Thank you.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking this hour about diagnosing and treating Lyme disease and about the blood-sucking ticks that carry Lyme. We're talking with Dr. William Schaffner, professor and chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine and professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Dr. Thomas Mather is professor of public health entomology and director of the Tick Encounter Resource Center at the University of Rhode Island. If you have questions about Lyme disease or ticks, 1-800-989-TALK, 1-800-989-8255. So, Dr. Schaffner, why is Lyme disease so tricky to diagnose?
Well, it's tricky to diagnose because, first of all, the skin lesion may not be something that you see if it's in a part of the anatomy that you don't normally look at. Second, it can be associated with a number of symptoms, not feeling so well, neck pain, headache, a sense of fatigue, and then chills and fever. You notice they're all rather nonspecific, and they may not be severe enough to take you to the doctor. And then, of course, the disease can have in its later phases some other manifestations. You can get more than one skin lesion, and you can have some neurologic effects. You can get a form of meningitis or a paralysis of one of the nerves of the face. So you can see these are unusual manifestations that both patients and some doctors won't put together if they are not familiar with the disease.
Jared's in New York City. Hi there, Jared.
Hi. My daughter had Lyme's disease for over a year, and the trouble we had with diagnosing it was, as we later learned, the symptoms show up differently in children than they do adults. She didn't have any skin lesions or any of the fevers, things like that, but she had swollen joints. And so between the episodes of these symptoms occurring, the doctors just didn't think it was just didn't think to check Lyme's disease. I just wanted to make that point. I'll take my response off the air.
Thank you very much, Jared. Dr. Schaffner, is that true? Do kids get it differently than adults?
Well, the emphasis may be a little bit different, but Jared is actually right. A later manifestation of Lyme disease can be arthritis of many of the different joints, but particularly of the larger joints. And that may not be a diagnosis that comes immediately to mind when you see a child with arthritis.
John's in Green Bay. Hi there, John.
Hello.
What's your question?
I had Lyme disease about 4 years ago. And had the whole range of symptoms, fever, chills, profuse sweating, 103-degree fever. I'm wondering if there's been any immunity connected now with my having had this in the past.
Good question. Is there immunity?
Yeah, John, there is some immunity, although second cases have been described on occasion. The important thing to also note is that these are treatable infections, and the earlier we can see the patient, the more effective and easy the treatment is.
Now, second cases is one thing. What about the idea of chronic Lyme disease? This is something that is very, very controversial. Some people say once you get Lyme disease, you can have Lyme disease forever. What do you think, Dr. Schaffner?
Well, you won't find that described in the medical literature. And it's controversial in the sense that there are indeed a group of people, patients, who have long-standing symptoms who believe they have a form of what is called chronic Lyme disease. But the medical evidence for that, the scientific evidence for that, is thin, if not non-existent. And so the experts don't believe that such a syndrome exists, and it must be another illness that is causing those symptoms.
But what about those people who have long-term illnesses, who keep coming back with some of the same things, some of these things that you've described before, maybe even neurological problems that persist after being diagnosed with Lyme disease?
Well, Lyme disease ought to be treated definitively, depending upon the stage of the illness, with antibiotics, and then to the best of our scientific evaluation of patients, they should be cured of the infection, and that if one has continuing symptoms, one would be advised to look elsewhere for a cause for those symptoms.
Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Indiana. Hi there, Mary.
Hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. Yep, okay. I had Lyme disease 21 years ago, and at the time I was 4.5 months pregnant. I went through the treatment, which for me had to be erythromycin because of a penicillin allergy. And my child was born with an angry red rash, and she's now 21, and boy, those rashes have persisted. She has a lot of allergy problems, and at the time of my diagnosis, the CDC didn't really have much information at all about Lyme disease and pregnancy, and I'm kind of wondering if there's much more information now.
Thanks, Mary.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure I have to respond to that. I can't look to Dr. Mather, but I'm not aware of a great deal of information on Lyme disease in pregnancy, and I'd have to go to the literature and look that up, John.
There were some studies back probably in the 90s that suggested statistically that there was no higher incidence of issues in human fetuses than from mothers with Lyme disease diagnoses than others. People had taken that to issue because they were smallish studies. We, at the time, had done a mouse study where, I know mice aren't people, but we showed that there actually was no congenital infection from infected mice to their offspring. So that calls into question whether there's any real relationship, but I would argue that probably more studies are needed.
Now, James is calling from New York. James has a question about the test for Lyme disease, an important question. Go ahead, James.
Hi, I have a chronic Lyme disease for 7 years, leading to widespread joint pain throughout my body. One of the first things that I suspected was that it was Lyme disease, and I got a Western blot test, and it came up false negative. 5 years later, after several doctors, I find out there was, in fact, Lyme disease with a more rigorous test. How often is there a false negative with Western blot?
Well, James, you open up all kinds of things. As I said, the diagnosis of chronic, so-called chronic Lyme disease is in medical circles suspect, and perhaps that first test was negative, and we are concerned about some laboratories that over-interpret weakly positive results. So I can't speak to your individual case, but would hope that you're in the hands of a good physician who's knowledgeable in this area.
Is it true, though, doctor, that the testing is not always reliable? You end up with false positives sometimes, false negatives. It's not as reliable, perhaps, as it could be. Why don't we have a better test for Lyme?
Well, science can do only what science can do, and we would all like a more precise test for Lyme disease. The testing is better now than it was 20, 25 years ago, and we just hope that the folks in the laboratory can come up with a better test.
So in the absence of some reliable testing and all these trickinesses about diagnoses, Dr. Mather, what about prevention? What can we do to keep ticks from feeding on us and passing on Lyme?
Well, there's a lot of great opportunities there, I think, that we already know, and there's ongoing research to try and improve that as well. Let me start with personal protection. The best personal protection against deer tick bites and pretty much any kind of tick bite is tick-repellent clothing, kind of something that people don't really know much about, despite the fact that the military has used this for 30 years to protect troops. It's clothing that is impregnated with the active ingredient permethrin. You can buy sprays and soaking kits and do it yourself, or there are commercially treated clothes available as well. And these clothes, it provides protection that really makes it's as easy to do as getting dressed in the morning if you do it regularly, because you have these treated clothes and they can go through, the commercially treated clothes can go through 70 washes and still be effective. So it's something that we wish more people knew about, because it takes just a brief contact with this clothing for the ticks to sort of fall off. And they don't just fall off if they've gotten enough of a dose, they actually die. So that's good news.
And Dr. Schaffner, very, very quickly, what should you do if you find a tick on your skin?
Well, the way to remove the tick is to take some tweezers, grasp the tick absolutely as close to the skin as possible, and then slowly pull back. Don't jerk the tweezers.
Because you don't want to leave anything behind.
You don't want to leave the head behind. That's correct, because then transmission can still occur.
We've just about run out of time here. Dr. William Schaffner is professor and chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine and professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, John.
Thanks also to Dr. Thomas Mather, professor of public health entomology and director of the Tick Encounter Resource Center at the University of Rhode Island. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
So if tiny ticks carrying Lyme disease weren't scary enough for you, how about something even creepier and crawlier? What happens when you see a spider in the sink? Do you panic? Do you shriek? Do you call in someone else to squash it? For arachnophobes, the fear is more intense. They might break out in a sweat, have difficulty breathing, and maybe even have to leave the room. I'm getting panicked just thinking about it. A new study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences show that therapy can tame those spider fears. How about you? Are you scared of spiders? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be talking about fears for the rest of this hour. Let me bring in our next guest. Katharina Hauner is a postdoctoral fellow in neurology at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. She was lead author of a study that used a tarantula named Florence to help people face and even overcome their fears. She joins us from Evanston, Illinois. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much.
Florence, huh?
Yes, that was her name.
So tell us about this study.
So we were interested in seeing how the brain changes after a person who has a phobia has been treated for it. And because we were able to use a therapy that works extremely effectively and extremely efficiently, it's just 2 hours long, we were able to look at changes in the brain that happen within just minutes after the therapy had been completed. And we were also interested in seeing how these changes develop over time. So we took the same individuals and looked at their brain activity 6 months after the initial study. And they hadn't had any additional intervention or treatment within that time, but because the therapy worked so well, they were still phobia-free 6 months later.
Okay, so how did you pick these people to be part of your study?
So these were individuals that were recruited from around the campus area. They were young adults, and we posted signs and advertisements asking if people were interested in overcoming their fear of spiders, and we got quite a few responses.
So you picked people who were afraid of spiders. Were you showing them pictures of spiders at first? How did you get them acclimated to this entire idea?
Well, they did see pictures of spiders in the scan, in the MRI scanner that was part of the study. What do you mean acclimated to the idea?
Well, over time, you eventually get them to touch Florence the spider.
Oh, I see. So the therapy involved, yeah, eventually they touch the spider after about 2 hours of this particular therapy called exposure therapy. But they didn't start off anywhere near the spider. These were people who were very terrified. So the way we did this is by a hierarchy of steps, each of which was first demonstrated by me, the therapist in the study, and the participant would follow along when they felt ready. So we started off, for example, about 10 feet away from the spider. The spider was in an enclosed terrarium, was quite far from them. They couldn't really see it. That's where we started. And then eventually we'd get closer and closer to touching the terrarium. And then eventually I would remove the spider from the terrarium to an open container. I think this is where the change really takes place, because that's where they learn that the spider's movements, the spider's behavior is predictable and controllable. So we would learn to first touch it a little bit with a paintbrush and observe its movements, and then with a thick glove, then with a thinner glove, and finally with just the bare hand.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from NPR. So what did the scan show after this therapy? How is it different from what you observed later? This is an amazing change in people after just a couple hours.
It was amazing to see, even just behaviorally, even just to observe them afterwards holding or touching the tarantula with their bare hands. And it was amazing for them as well. They couldn't believe it. But in terms of what the brain showed, one of the most interesting findings was that an area of the brain that is part of the prefrontal cortex, so this is an area that's associated with inhibition of fear or emotions or effortful control of fear, this region showed increased activity immediately after the therapy, hadn't been active prior to the therapy. So within minutes, there's this change. And then 6 months later, actually, the same region showed a decrease in activity, even though the participants were still phobia-free 6 months later.
We have a call here from Phil in Boise. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
So what's your question?
Well, as a child, I was bit by a black widow, and I suffered some severe trauma. And my current trade is a plumber. I've been a plumber for 8 years, and I see spiders, and I really can't move. It's really debilitating, and in my trade, it's kind of hard to actually do my job being as afraid of spiders as I am. As a matter of fact, I have my wife get in crawl spaces sometimes to kill them for me. And I'm wondering how effective this treatment is going to be and how available it's going to be, and what process is it in currently?
Yeah, can you help out Phil here?
Sure. So that's a really good question. A lot of participants in this study had fears that were equal to that. This therapy has been available for decades, so it's actually very well established, and maybe the only surprising thing is that very few people know about it. In terms of availability, it's not necessary to seek out a therapist who specializes in spider exposure therapy, because exposure therapy for all phobias involves the same procedure. So as long as you can find a therapist who has experience with exposure therapy in general, and actually I can give you a website for finding one. A good resource for this is Association of Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies, and the website is A, B as in boy, C as in Charlie, T as in tree, .org, ABCT.org, and they have a find a therapist link, and depending on where you live, you might be able to find one very close to you or not, but if they have experience in exposure therapy or CBT in general, actually, because exposure therapy is a component of CBT, you should be fine.
We're talking with Katharina Hauner, a postdoctoral fellow in neurology at Northwestern University. We're talking about the fear of spiders, a new way to perhaps overcome this fear. We'll be broadening the discussion to all fears, and we want to hear from you, 1-800-989-TALK, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. What are the things that frighten you? And maybe we can find some help for you coming up next.
Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts.
This is Science Friday, and I'm John Dankosky. We're talking this hour about therapy for people with a phobia of spiders and how the brain processes fear. Katharina Hauner is a postdoctoral fellow in neurology at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and lead author of a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that we've been talking about. This study, though, raises some larger questions. Why are some people scared of spiders while others aren't? I want to bring in Dr. Todd Farchione, who's director of the Intensive Treatment Program at the Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders and a research assistant professor of psychology at Boston University. Dr. Farchione, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, John. I'm glad to be here.
So why are some people so scared of spiders?
Well, you know, there's a few things. First, let me say that fears, you know, certain fears are sort of, you know, probably built in, so that from an evolutionary standpoint, it's important to be afraid of certain things. And there's research to actually suggest that some fears are easier to learn than others. But it does appear that some people may be more predisposed to develop fears than other people.
Fears, anxieties, phobias, what's the difference?
Well, fear is more of they're just different kind of emotional states. Fear is actually much more of an immediate sort of fight or flight reaction, whereas anxiety is proceeds over a longer period of time and tends to be more future-focused, involves things like a greater state of hyperarousal, sort of looking for the threat. And then fear would really be the emotional response that someone would experience in the presence of the situation or object that they're afraid of.
And at a certain point, though, this fear, this anxiety can become actually harmful to us. When does this happen? How do we characterize that harm that fear can cause?
Well, I think as far as the a diagnosis of a specific phobia, what we look for clinically is an excessive fear that the individual recognizes as being irrational, and it also causes interference for the person or is very distressing to the individual. So a lot of people will report fears. Again, you know, I mean, I think these are common things to be afraid of, like spiders and snakes and being high up, you know, and for some people, it becomes very excessive, very intense, and can become interfering for them.
Let's go to Rob, who's calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi there, Rob.
Hi, guys. It's an interesting conversation because I don't know if it's arachnophobia or how you'd classify it, but I was never afraid of spiders my whole life until I watched my friend get bit by a recluse, a brown recluse. And the absolute sickness he went through and all the problems. And ever since then, now any spider I see automatically in my mind is a brown recluse, and it bothers me.
Wow. Is that part of it, Dr. Farchione? Someone sees a terrible incident, maybe as a child, or maybe you see a friend get bit, and then all of a sudden you go into being an arachnophobe?
Yes. Yeah, that does happen sometimes. So there's a few different ways that we can learn to be afraid of things. One is to actually experience the trauma ourselves. Then there's a couple other ways. One is sort of just information that we pick up along the way. So a lot of times the media, you know, has a role in that. And then finally, sort of vicarious learning, seeing somebody else be afraid of something. And that's sort of we can pick up fears like that as well.
Let's go to Karen in Morgan Hill, California. Hi there, Karen. Go ahead. Karen, go ahead.
I'm curious, because I am definitely afraid of spiders, and I'm curious if there were people who went through your study who were not successful.
Catherine Hauner, anybody who just couldn't make it touching the tarantula there?
No, all 12 made it, and actually that's not surprising given the numbers. Between 95 to 98% of people are successful using this 2 to 3 hour therapy.
Why is that? Why is it so successful?
Well, overcoming fear is really about prediction and control. And so the therapy, during the therapy, one learns how to approach the feared object or situation, in this case a spider, so that it is no longer unpredictable or uncontrollable, which makes the object or situation less threatening. And with spiders, this is quite easy to facilitate because their movements, or at least with tarantulas, they're quite slow. It makes them very easy to predict and to control oneself.
But I can only assume, Dr. Farchione, that not everything is so easy to control. I mean, if you have a fear of flying, you can't just get up in planes all the time for exposure therapy.
Actually, yeah. I'm sorry.
Oh, God.
The same treatment has been used 2 to 3 hours successfully for flying as well.
It has been?
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, often a flight simulator is used.
Yeah. Ah, okay.
So virtual reality, there's some virtual reality programs that could be useful for flying in particular, because it is sort of hard to recreate repeatedly.
Well, and I assume, Dr. Farchione, that there are other things, other phobias that people can have that might be very, very difficult to treat through exposure therapy, or is there a way to treat everything?
I mean, exposure tends to be an essential component of treatments across the different anxiety disorders, and I would say with the specific phobias, it is at the heart of any good treatment for specific phobias.
If you have questions about your fears, your phobias, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFi. Our guests are Dr. Todd Farchione, the director of the Intensive Treatment Program at the Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders, and a research assistant professor of psychology at Boston University. Katharina Hauner is postdoctoral fellow in neurology at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, a lead author in the study and the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Don's on the line from St. Cloud, Minnesota. Hi there, Don.
John, I'm afraid of tiny spiders, but not large ones. I can hold tarantulas and daddy long legs and house spiders and garden spiders with no problem at all, but the little tiny ones bother me.
Okay, little tiny spiders. Do you have any idea why? Is it because they move so fast? They're unpredictable, unlike these slow-moving tarantulas, Don?
I have no clue. I'm not afraid of anything except bears and tiny spiders.
That's a pretty wide range. Thanks for your phone call. Any thoughts for Don?
Yeah, if I could. It is interesting. You do see that sometimes with treatment, actually. It's interesting that you can do an exposure treatment with, say, a tarantula. And sometimes what you'll get is that the person will no longer be afraid of the tarantula, but it doesn't always translate over to them not being afraid of other spiders. Now, a lot of times it does, but for some people the fears may be, you know, in such a way that you have to develop other exposures to sort of help them. So the tarantulas do move fairly quickly, whereas the small spiders move the tarantulas move fairly slowly. The other ones move faster. So it's interesting. They've done a lot of research on what's called return of fear. And sometimes what you'll see is somebody could be treated in a laboratory setting, but then you sort of take them out into the real world, and they'll actually get some fear that will come up. It's sort of the idea is it's a different context. And the same applies, I think, for the spider. So with treatments, to make them more effective, you would expose the individual not only to the tarantulas, but also to the little spiders, different colors, different spiders that move in different ways, and that seems to be most effective long term.
And that context is important. If you find a spider hidden in your basement and it scares you, that's a much different thing than in a laboratory setting, isn't it?
Right. Right. Yeah, that's the basic idea.
Well, let's go to Jackie in Pueblo. Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
I have a kind of an opposition to put to this, too. I think you can be trained into the fear as well as possibly trained out of it. I grew up in and around tarantulas. I have seen them migrate in their thousands across the highways in southern
wow.
New Mexico.
Oh, God.
I have been, and you just run over them. You couldn't not run over them.
Wow.
And they're kind of slimy when you do that.
Yeah.
And I've been chased down a garden row by one that's hopping in about 4 foot length hops. I discovered I could outrun him. and they come in different colors down in New Mexico. Some are brown, some are with an orange spot on their back, and some are yellow with an orange spot on the back. And right behind all of this, why are people afraid of spiders but not afraid of ants? And I will turn my radio back up and listen.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you just freaked us out, Jackie. I know that. any thoughts about what Jackie has to say? I mean, can you be trained into a fear?
I think it's possible as to why someone is afraid of spiders and not ants. I think that goes back to what Dr. Farchione was explaining previously, which is that some spiders are poisonous and are even deathly, whereas as far as I know, that's not the case with ants. It's actually the second author on the study, Dr. Susan Minico, is responsible for some of this.
Oh, Sue Minico, okay.
Yeah. She was
all right.
Yeah, responsible for some of this research showing that non-human primates they learn to be afraid of snake-like objects more quickly than similar objects. And I think the same can be applied to spiders, that it's evolutionarily advantageous, potentially, to show more quick learning to an animal that might be deadly.
Dr. Farchione, do you want to pick up on that there?
No, I mean, Sue Minico has done a lot of work in how fears are sort of established, and I think that's entirely accurate. You know, it's easier to, like, I think there was research, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there's research with that Sue did with monkeys, rhesus monkeys, showing that it was easier to condition a fear of snakes than it was to condition a fear of things such as flowers. So mm-hmm. that it's sort of it's, you know, primates and human beings were predisposed to or prepared to sort of fear certain things as opposed to other things. So we can learn those fears much more easily.
Of course, we can't test this directly, but it seems a good explanation and it seems to hold up with what humans tend to be most afraid of.
But fear certain things like snakes, which don't have legs, or things like spiders that have eight legs. I mean, is it just because they're so different than us?
No, they can harm us.
Yes, it could be that they can. Some snake
poisonous.
Bites are deadly. Some spider bites are deadly, whereas ant bites are not.
But there's lots of poisonous things in the world that look totally harmless.
And I think, in general, people would develop a phobia to those things more quickly.
All right. Well, if you want to join us, 1-800-989-TALK, 1-800-989-8255. I'm John Benkoski, and this is Science Friday from NPR. Tom's in Cincinnati. Hey there, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Science Friday.
My name's Tom. I'm pretty afraid of spiders, and a couple of years ago I bought a large sailboat, and it seems to be a spider magnet. And over the last couple of years, through sort of empirically exposing myself to these spiders and seeing that they control all the other bugs from coming onto the sailboat, I've sort of developed a symbiotic relationship with them, and I take the broom out and gently place them on the dock and go sail my boat. And it's sort of sounds like I've developed this exposure therapy.
Yeah,
you know,
like
empirically myself.
Yeah, you did what you needed to do there, Tom.
I'm wondering, Katharina Hauner, if you can talk a bit more about what happens next with some of this research that you're doing. Is there a next step for you?
Well, for me, the next step would be applying these procedures to other disorders, other anxiety disorders that don't respond quite as well to treatment.
Like what?
So these would be anxiety disorders like social anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder.
And Dr. Farchione, how much more difficult are some of these other disorders to conquer?
Well, the rates of improvement, you know, the number of individuals that show sort of clinically significant change tends to be less than it is with the specific phobias. And it's not entirely clear why that is. It may be that in part with the specific phobias in conducting the exposure, it's just it's less complicated. It's more direct and you have more control over certain factors. There may be less of a cognitive component, perhaps, with the specific phobias, but than there are with the other disorders. But you know, we've been applying exposure treatment to the other disorders for some time, and the treatment, again, it's not as effective as what you see with the specific phobias, but for a lot of the disorders, it's actually pretty good for the anxiety disorders.
Yeah, I think that's important to emphasize that the treatments are effective, but the you might not see improvement in the 2 to 3 hours that you do
right.
with something
right.
like spider phobia.
Is there anything that we can learn from this to help people with post-traumatic stress disorder coming back from a war, something that we hear so much about, people who are afraid of so many things in their own surroundings once they get back from a dangerous place?
I think with post-traumatic stress disorder, it's a bit more complicated because you have these immediate fears, as you would with a specific phobia, but then on top of that, you have additional symptoms that are unrelated to specific phobias, such as these flashbacks and hallucinations and recurrent thoughts and dreams. It's far more complex, and this disorder is also associated with a different different regions of the brain are active when people with post-traumatic stress disorder are experiencing these symptoms. So it's a bit more complex.
That said, there is a considerable amount of data to suggest that exposure therapy, what's called prolonged exposure, can be effective for post-traumatic stress disorder. The work of Patricia Riesick and Edna Foa comes to mind. But there is data for the efficacy of an exposure-based treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder as well, although it is more complicated.
Just the last thing for you, Dr. Farchione, is there something that people can do, some specific place you'd tell them to look if they feel as though they have a debilitating phobia, just an overwhelming fear in their lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think the resource that was provided to the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies actually is a very good resource, abct.org. There are also some self-help treatments out there. There's one published by Oxford University Press that is very good for specific phobias and other anxiety disorders as well.
Is this the Mastery of Your Specific Phobia
book
that
you're thinking
of?
That's the one I'm thinking of, yes.
So the authors for that book are Anthony Kraske and Barlow, and it's available on Amazon. I just think it's helpful for people to know that actually, especially for specific phobias, there's evidence to show that treating yourself can actually be almost as effective as seeing a therapist. So,
good point. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And where people run into problems, I think, with the treatments is they start the treatment and they expose themselves to the thing that they're afraid of, and sometimes they'll escape or they'll run away at the point that the fear becomes very intense. And that's actually not what they want to be doing. It can, in fact, sort of backfire on them and sensitize them a little bit more to the thing that they're afraid of. So it is important to either, you know, look at self-help books or to talk with somebody. If the fear is very intense, if it's at the level of what you would see with a phobia, to talk with a therapist to get that assistance.
And I have to jump in because I just sure. about have run out of time, but I want to thank Dr. Todd Farchione from Boston University and Katherine Hauner from Northwestern University for allaying some of our fears. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you very much.
Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. You can go to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can always follow us on Twitter at SciFry. In New York, I'm John Dankosky.